This is a recording of Robin Hall of Hall's Garage, 8 The Green, Rowlands Castle, made on the 26th of April, 2005.
My name is Robin Hall. I was born on the 20th of June, 1940, in Rowlands Castle. The Hall family have been here for several generations. My grandfather's grandfather came here as a shoemaker in about 1805, 1810. He picked Rowlands Castle because he had received a bursary from the Goodyear Trust in Berriton of £10 to become a premium apprentice shoemaker. He did his 7 years apprenticeship starting in 1795, and then early in the 1800s went off as a journeyman and found Rowlands Castle, which didn't have an established shoemaker. Other villages in the area already had an established shoemaker, and he couldn't trade in those villages. So he picked Rowlands Castle as being an up-and-coming place. Here we are, several generations later, still here. We were shoemakers, father and son, until about 1910, when my grandfather died of appendicitis. My father at the time was only about 7 years old. He had no interest in the shoemaking business, but in fact we did live in Finchdean Road in those days, number 11 Finchdean Road. We had a shop there as a shoemaker's shop, which still existed when I was a small boy. It had been used for other things. The house I was born in 1940, I lived until 1985, when I moved out and went to Westbourne. Westbourne, I in fact moved to Forestside. Bought a cottage that we'd wanted to buy for many years, restored it, and I live there now.
Where was it in Forestside?
It's at Warren Down. Warren Down Cottage, where I live at the moment, in fact was my mother's house, the house that she came to. My mother was born in Portsmouth, came as a girl with her father, who was a First World War naval petty officer, and with his naval time, or due to his naval time, he had contracted TB, and they had to move out of the smoky atmosphere of Portsmouth and come and live in the countryside. So they came and rented the house in Forestside. I stayed there a few times during the war as a child, because although my grandfather had died and my grandmother had moved away, an aunt had taken the house over, and I used to go up and stay with them from time to time, and always liked it. They still rented it from Stansted. Eventually, after several times of trying to buy it, I bought the house in 1985, and we restored it, and I moved back in there. We've now been there 20 years or so. My mother, named Jean Bullingham, married my father, who was a widower. His first wife had died of leukemia, and they married in the late 30s. and she remained in Roland's castle, looking after me during the war, and until she died just last year, or this year, at 88. I first went to school in Red Hill. On my first day at school, I'll never forget it, Miss Baker, formidable lady, called out the names of the new people. Robin Hall, you'll sit there. Graham Martin, you can sit there. Graham Fells, you can sit at the back. And then when we all sat there, your fathers were trouble. I expect you'll be. My father was 38 years older than me, but he was still, Miss Baker was his infant's teacher as she was mine. Then it came to being issued with our first reader, the Beacon Reader. She fished them all out, gave them out very carefully, and my father's name was in the book. Needless to say, having been prejudged like that, I didn't get on very well at school. And my father, who also didn't like Miss Baker, took me out of Red Hill after a year. And I went to Idsworth School. Mrs. Streak, the headmistress of Idsworth School, was an even older lady. She'd actually taught my mother's mother, my grandmother. But being wartime and just after the war, of course, these people went on teaching till quite a late age. Mrs. Streak was very good and a much more even-handed person. She didn't prejudge me, and I did very well there. Perhaps it was only the fact that there were only 32 children in the school anyway. And it was rather like an extended family. But unfortunately, in 1948, the school closed. And I then got sent with all the rest to Horndean School. That lasted for about a month or 6 weeks. When the attendance officer came round and said, "You're not supposed to be here, this isn't your area," sent me home. "You'll have to go back to Red Hill." Well, my father refused. And the argument raged for several months while I stayed at home. Eventually, I went for a short while to Sussex. Heinous crime. You should never go across the county border to school. And until they found out about me and sent me home again. So I had another period at home. And eventually the telephone rang and it said, a lady said, "I hear you're having trouble with your son's education." So my father said, "Yes, who are you?" "Well, I'm Mrs. Dyer, the headmistress of the Catholic school in Havant." "Send him here." "But we're not Catholic," said my father. "I'd take the devil himself if I could keep my school open," she said. So I went there. It was a very rude awakening for a poor country lad to go to Havant to school, where there were only about four or five families in the school. They numbered some hundred.
How did you go to school? How did you
travel? I went initially on the bus, and then rode, from the time I was about nine, I rode my bike.
And where was the Catholic school?
It was then St. Joseph's, which was in West Street, near Crossway. And, well, as I say, it was a rough old school. But I still see the people today, and some of them. And the salt of the earth, lovely people. One small story about that school was that one of my special pals, I'll not mention his name because he it would be unfair. It was a skinny, tall, blonde lad with matchsticks for legs. Behind hanging out of his trousers, and the most magnificent pair of army boots you've ever seen. They shone with hobnails, and you could always hear him coming. Years later, I saw him. He came to work for me, and I said, "I remember you with the skinny legs and the behind hanging out of your trousers. And those wonderful boots, you must have loved those boots." "I hated them, mate," he said. I said, "But you polished them." He said, "Yes. Mrs. Dyer, the headmistress, gave them to me, and if they weren't polished, she'd give me the stick." And then I went on to, in the education system, when that school closed in the middle, early 50s, I was about 11 or 12, I went to the secondary school in Happen. And carried on, lazing through life, until one day one of the masters said, "You lazy great lump." He was rather ruder than that, but "you always come somewhere in the top few, in the top class, if it suits you, but if you were really knuckled down, you could do something. Why don't you go in for the GCE? I didn't even know what it was. So we soon found out that he would sponsor me to the first class of secondary pupils to take the O level. It was being held at Cowplain. So my father agreed, and I went off to Cowplain to school, still riding my bike. And we were a bit of an experiment, I think. We were all 14 years old, coming 15 years old. Never done a stroke of work in our lives. And we were given 7 GCE subjects at O level to pass or to take. No teachers. We just had to work for ourselves, sit in on such classes that took those subjects, and the staff there would help us, and they did. They worked very hard on us. Apart from 5 of the 24 who fell out very early on, couldn't stand the self-discipline, the rest of us stuck the course for 2 years, and nobody got less than 5 subjects. Most of us got 6 or 7. So at late 16s, I was then 16 and a bit. I had to go on to A-levels. But A-levels weren't held at secondary schools, so I was given a place in Purbrook Grammar School. I hated it, back into sitting in class and working at the other's speed, and threw it all in very shortly after that. And left school of my own accord at 17. And armed with my few O-levels, managed to get myself Minivag veterinary course.
And where was that?
It started off in Sparshall Agricultural College. We were filtered out. We then were doing a year. We did a year in practical work around the farms, and then back to Reading University to continue our course. So I would have become a vet if I were lucky, but not the sort of thing as we accept a vet today. I was a heavy vet, working for the Ministry of Agriculture. That was the idea. But halfway through that, my father fell ill, and as he was subsidizing me fairly heavily to do so, the course was free, but the rest wasn't. I had to come back in and run the business. So at coming 19, I suppose, I got chucked back into the motor trade with no So I was thrown back into the motor trade 1959. My father had started the garage in 1928. He, in fact, was one of the very early motor apprentices. My grandfather, having died when he was seven, got himself an apprenticeship during the First World War with Barrett's, the garage on the hill, and became there, I think, probably other than Bill Barrett, who wasn't a true motor apprentice, he was an engineering apprentice, he was their first motor apprentice. And he worked for them until the early 20s, when he went off to be Canning's mechanic, Canning's being the iron foundry in Finchdean, and after that a foreman at a garage in Havant, Horace Carver, and then came here and started his own business in 1928. He had a few open-fronted bits behind the Castle Inn and a workshop down in the old bootmaking shop, where he did repairs to all sorts of steam engines, cars, rewired houses, mended gramophones, anything. And came to our premises here on the Green in 1947. He'd had the garage built. They bought the land on Mr. Wigington, Percy Wigington of Wigington and Hearn, had decided to sell the property. And my mother's mother was working there and said, "My son-in-law would like that, Harry, for a garage." And Percy Wigington agreed to sell it to him. It was a field. This originally was the holding field for the slaughterhouse behind Wigington and Hearn. And we had the garage built, and they moved in 1947. So he'd run it really from 47 to 59, a relatively short time when I came back in here. And he had already had some health problems and developed heart disease, and in fact died in 1964. So I took over totally in 1964. I had to get myself a few quick qualifications, but such was the way of things in those days that they weren't too difficult for a lad who'd been sort of studying veterinary training and what have you, and also had had a great deal of experience in here as a boy. And to show how experienced one had to be, we were MOT testers, not the earliest, but pretty early. And in 1960, I was 20 still, and my father was ill, and the MOT testing chief engineer came round to vet me to see if I was good enough to be an MOT tester. Now, it think of this, I've had a year's experience back in the garage. He walked in, said to my father, "Is he any good, Harry?" So my father said, "Yeah, he'll make it, he's all right." "Okay, son, you can start." And that was my interview. And I've just given it up now. I've been an MOT tester for over 40 years. It's about time I gave it up. I've slowly expanded the business. It was just myself and one other here at the time. And he wasn't experienced either. He was a retired farmer. And we're gradually expanded, and there are now about 8 of us around. Perhaps 10, I think, in total now, yes, including ourselves, though I do very little these days. And hopefully we keep up with the times. And we seem to have a reasonable name, having stuck 40 years in the same place. We've managed to tread the thin line of making a profit and pleasing the customer. So we've, from the business side, we've been part of the expansion of Rowland's Castle. My time in the garage has been one of general expansion, as I say. I've grown with the village. And in the late 60s, early 70s, in order to expand, I managed to buy the then Rowland's Castle Telephone Exchange, which was behind this garage here, and now the land is just a corner of the workshop. But it enabled us to expand backwards and do a little more work that way. And then in the late 70s, the international store, which had been Wigington and Hearn, had been B&H Rook before Wigington and Hearn. Bert and Harry Rook developed the business into quite a wide and thriving general store, as one would have in those days. They had their own bakehouse, their own butchery department, and their own slaughterhouse, as well as a general groceries and wine merchants, and probably employed some 20 or 30 people. They had wide-ranging rounds, two vans on the road. When we bought this establishment, which was a series of brick sheds and the houses next door to the garage, we bought it from the Wigington family. Dorothy Wigington was looking to sell it because it was becoming a burden to her. She was at present leasing it to the International Tea Company, the international stores. And so I bought it. They had closed it and became their landlord because they were still paying. They still had a very long lease. They were paying rent for it. So I wrote to them and said, would they like to be released from their obligations on this empty store? And they said not really, they would wish to continue it, but would get out for a consideration of £10,000. I said, no, stay there, then you're quite welcome to stay. And by the way, you're on a full repairing lease, it needs painting. A few minutes later, Robert Winnicott came over to me and said, I thought you'd bought that. I said, I have. The international wanted painted, so I said, yeah, and explained to him. So it was totally painted at a cost of about £2,000, and I remade the offer of, would they like to be released from their obligations, and they said, yes, please. Search them right. I had it freshly painted. We then developed it. I needed the land behind for car parking. That was my basic need. Because the village was getting busier, and we were getting busier, so I bought it basically for the parking in the rear, which we still use. An interesting sideline was that we were looking to let some of this property to recoup some of the overheads and some of the outgoings. And we got much interest from a strange section of society. We weren't sure what they wanted to rent it for, but on quizzing the third person to want a particular part of this business, they told us that we still had a license for a slaughterhouse. And the license had never been rescinded, and they would keep it as a slaughterhouse and butcher's shop. Not really wanting a slaughterhouse on my property, I declined the offer, and one assumes that the slaughterhouse license is now gone, but it was a very strange time. We've developed that corner alongside the garage, and we now let some of it, and parts of the family have lived in some of it. Well, my mother lived in a flat in there for a long time, but we still have it. My father's sister Frances married Bill Barrett. Barrett's owned the other garage in the village, in fact the senior garage in the village. They came here into Rowland's Castle from Portsmouth about 1890, run by Grandpa Barrett, an ex-steam engineer from the Navy, and he worked the garage right the way through till 1940-ish, during the war. At the age of 90-odd, he did give up, more or less, but he died at the age of 100 in 1946 or 7. His son carried on working the business. He was never a practical garage man. He had got a club foot, was not particularly fit. He did all the business side of it. So much of the work was handed on to his grandson, my uncle by marriage, Bill Barrett. And Bill ran the business right the way through till the 80s, died at the age of 94 or 5, and his son Bernard has suffered from ill health, still alive, but in fact retired, as most people should, around their 60s. So the garage no longer exists, so we've now become the senior garage in the village.
Did either garage have a petrol pump?
We both had petrol pumps, yes. We were Esso, they were Shell, and like all small garages, we sold petrol, never made any money out of it, but it was all part of the system in those days. When they closed, they ceased to sell petrol because they had to serve on the road with swing over pumps. We struggled on till the middle 90s selling petrol, and the day I gave it up we all breathed a great sigh of relief. My wife gave a great cheer, because it was several hours a day's work that never made any money. But we were always afraid that we might not be able to survive by not selling petrol, but in fact it made almost no difference. I'm very pleased not to do it, and I feel sorry for those player garages that still do. In 1962, I married Susan Green, spinster of the next parish, in fact, although she lived only a few hundred yards away. And we lived first in Finchdean, in a bungalow in Finchdean, until 66, 67, something like that, when our second child, our first being Catherine, Kate arrived in 66, 65, and in 67 Peter came, and the small place in Finchdean was getting rather small. My mother, a widow by that time, was getting fed up of living in the family house in Rowlands Castle. So I bought the family house from her, and she moved to Forestside to another house. And we lived from 67 till 85 in Finchdean Road in the old family house when I sold it. The children, Kate went to the local schools and prospered very well. The education system suited her. Peter, more academic, went to Portsmouth Grammar School. And in fact, we have now one very brainy but not particularly full of common sense son and an exceedingly full of common sense daughter. Not particularly academic, but they now live, Peter lives in Lancaster. That was his total choice. He's his grandfather's grandson. That's Sue, my wife's father. An academic, a free thinker. He's now a consulting engineer, yes. He went to university, got his master's degree, and has become a consulting engineer. When I spoke to him not too long ago, I speak to him regularly, but I spoke to him not too long ago when he said, "What have you been doing this week?" Monday I was working for United Cocoa, doing an explosives check on cocoa powder. Tuesday I was on an oil rig in the Irish Sea, doing some mud recovery equipment. Wednesday I was in the office. Thursday I was on Heysham Nuclear Power Station checking the outfall of the nuclear fallout from the equipment for it. And Friday I was working on Thomas the Tank Engine. So he has a varied life. He's a keen potholer. This is his reason for living in the north. And in fact, his entire life revolves around his hobbies and his family. I must admit, he works very hard for them. My daughter is now living in Shepperton in South London. She's married to a policeman and is in fact teaching in Feltham Young Offenders Institute. And a job that she loves. So they've both settled very well. They have three children between them. I have a grandson with Peter and a grandson and daughter with Kate. I can't remember specifically when the village fair started, but in about its third year of operation, it was short of a chairman to chair the show, if you like, and I was given the job. I in fact ran it for several years. That would be wrong to say. I think it was run very ably by, amongst others, Betty Seeley and... good heavens, I can't even remember the lady's name now. But they worked exceedingly hard. I sat on the fence, rather, and just presided over the arguments that reigned. And it was originally started as the Rowlands Castle Children's Village Fair, and it was started and sponsored in the initial instance by Eddie Reeves, who kindly gave us a large sum of money to get it off the ground and continued to support it for several years. It has now become the Rowlands Castle Fair, I believe. I don't think the children's name is still in it. But it still goes on with people working extremely hard and has become quite a success. The nearest I can think of it in the old days was the Rowlands Castle Flower Show, which was sponsored really by the Tory Party, which was a big event in our days. Was held variously in odd large houses, originally I believe in Deerleek, though that was before my time, latterly in Colonel Farmer's house in Bowes Hill, a large house much of the land has now been built on, and also I think once or twice at Oakland's, Stubbington's house. It was a well looked for event. We thoroughly enjoyed that. Other than that, the only village events I can think of were the celebrations to end the hostilities, you know, the war in VE Day and VJ Day. VE Day was very much a spontaneous explosion of joy and relief, I'm sure. I can't really remember it in detail, being only 5 years old at the time, but I can remember being bewildered by the fact of what is peace, because I'd never known anything but war. And it was a very bewildering but pleasurable time. I remember dancing around a large bonfire in the middle of the road here, which was being fed by all the bunts from Charlie Royal, the baker's bakehouse bunts. So much so, I think Charlie probably had a few too many to drink as well, because he was helping throw them on. And the next morning, my father and a few others had to go up into the woods and get something to light them, to get the baker's oven alight to be able to bake the bread. But I don't think that mattered too much in those days. A little story about bakers. There were two bakers in the village. Charlie Royals, the major baker, and the baker belonging to Wigington and Herne, and George Farr was the baker for Wigington and Herne. The bakehouse was in the back of the large shop, and they baked bread in a brick oven with wood, using again wooden bunts, bundles of hazel tied up. Tradition said that you, at the end of the baking, you chucked a couple of bunts in the bake oven, the oven, to dry out, ready to flash up in the morning and light up, so that they burnt well, they totally dry. What happened was that they finished baking, and sometime the following night, poor old George Farr had a brain tumour and had a stroke and was taken into hospital, so there was no baking. And in fact, Wigington's baked no bread thereafter, bricked the oven up and turned the bakehouse into part of the shop when extending it. When I bought the shop in the 80s, we demolished some of these old buildings, including the brick oven. And when we broke into it from the top, there were the bunts still in there, waiting to be lit. Above the bread oven was the salt cellar, being the warmest place in it. They stored the salt in there simply to keep it dry. It had a very small doorway, probably 18 inches wide and 3 feet high, and as such it was only the baker's boy or the errand boys that could get up there and collect the salt, which was also a good place to hide away from the management. And we found dozens of lemonade bottles up there where somebody pinched a bottle of lemonade and taken it up to drink, going back for many years. In fact, we've still got some of them at home, stone lemonade bottles. But yes, to go back, the other celebration was VJ Day, rather more organized affair, and that was a large bonfire. I don't think there were fireworks, there was certainly dancing. And it was held in the field beside the drift, where the bungalows are built now, on Stubbington's land. And a very large bonfire, which we all danced around, and I fell in the pond and slit my arm, and I've still got a scar there to prove it. So I've been carrying that for about 60 years. Next celebration was the coronation, 1952. That was, again, very well organized. And the highlight of the day was a fancy dress parade. The highlight of the day for us children then was a fancy dress parade. My father had decided that our entry was to be a sedan chair, with myself at 12 years of age and my next door neighbour Mike May at 13 years of age, and my sister as the first Queen Elizabeth in the sedan chair. So they built this, and we were to walk from Stansted Park Gate to the wreck. So we tried it. Yes, this was all right, no problem. Until we got into the swing, and the poor old sedan chair started bouncing, and my sister, "Oh, I'm going to feel sick," and what have you. But she, being a trooper, she stuck it out. Unbeknown to us, we had to do a complete tour of the village. And my arms haven't really got back into the sockets yet. Anyway, we were rewarded. Having got there, we got third place, which was 2 shillings between the three of us. And my father sported the other shilling so that we each had a bob. But my earliest memories were of Stansted Park, living close to and right beside Stansted Park. Of course, there were thousands of soldiers waiting for D-Day. And we were allowed to crawl through the wire. And it must have been 1943, late 43, And we crawled through the wire taking apples into the soldiers, who one assumes weren't allowed out. And we were rewarded with dried fruit for our mums. We could bring this back. This was a good idea. They all more or less left just before D-Day, and I can remember trails of enormous lorries, dozens of them, tanks from end to end on the village green, soldiers living in them, under them, all around them, waiting to go out. And all the soldiers in Finchdean Road, which was my own patch, were given one fries milk bar, milk chocolate bar each. Well, of course, never having seen chocolate before, or very little, and being 4 years old, coming five, I was sort of a bit of a patsy, you know. I was sent along looking hungry and gathered up quite a lot of this chocolate. I had like 6 or 7 bars of chocolate. And I thought I was doing very well here until I came away and a bigger boy, I'll tell you now, it was Robin Barnes, took it all away from me. I assume he ate it. I've just heard that Robin Barnes has had to retire early through ill health. He's had heart trouble, so I don't know whether it was the chocolate that started it. But having vacated Stansted Park, of course Stansted Park was an army camp waiting to be occupied, and apart from a few prisoners coming back and occupying it, and displaced persons, it was empty. And it was our happy hunting ground as children. And right up until quite a long time after the war, we used to go through digging the coal out of the coal heaps, bringing it back to burn, selling it round the village for 6p a box, a soap box on wheels. And we made our money that way.
No,
Pete comes
back
to
some in the 70s.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Where were they at Stansted?
Yes. Well, the entire, I think the entire forest was taken up with somebody within Stansted.
Yes.
Certainly as a 5 and 6 year old, just after the war, when it was deserted, we used to roam a couple of miles, a mile and a half up into the woods, and there were all the huts still there.
In fact, the gamekeeper never sent you out?
Well, he would have done if he'd caught us, but we roughly knew where he was, and I'm sure he probably knew where we were but didn't bother. There's always been this, and it still exists, this, I won't say neutrality, but this acceptance of certain people to walk through the woods, simply because they also extended the knowledge and the policing of the woods. It still happens today. We live close to a pheasant run. No, I don't shoot pheasants, I have nothing to do with it, but we can wander at will through this simply because